watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this week
you're tuned to EOS Geneva, WXX Fenner Syracuse, 88.1, Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. From December 13th through the 18th, the fifth ministerial of the World Trade Organization will convene in Hong Kong in order to pursue expansion of an international treaty that seeks to make neoliberalism, that is, unrestrained market capitalism, the dominant framework for societies worldwide. Its proponents describe this process as free trade, but its opponents see it as a corporate attack on democracy and the environment. We'll begin the program this week with A People's History of the WTO by Irish documentarian Ian MacDonald.
The WTO is a Geneva-based multilateral institution with a mandate for the progressive liberalization of world trade, which is doubtlessly quite fascinating if you're a trade lawyer. But why do children sing about it in the villages of India? Why does it evoke riots and anger and songs? Why does it give birth to movements and enrage the world's poor?
Why are these people from India here?
What could be so interesting about the WTO to stir such a fuss?
Why are these people from Uganda here?
In the next hour, we invite you to listen to the story of the institution.
Why did they come up from Mexico in buses to be here?
Not from the perspective of a trade lawyer, but instead, a people's history of the WTO.
What's going on?
The World Trade Organization was supposed to be set up as the guiding organization made up of governments that would devise the rules for free trade, devise the rules for bringing down trade barriers among countries. The guiding ideology behind the WTO was that free trade was good, and the more trade was freed from constraints, the more trade would be able to bring about prosperity. That was the idealized version of the World Trade Organization.
Subaltern Productions presents A People's History of the WTO.
November 30th, 1999, history walking on a tightrope line, big money pulling on invisible strings, getting into everything.
Yeah, my name is Jim Page, and I'm a guitar player, a singer, and a songwriter guy in Seattle.
In November 1999, the World Trade Organization held its third ministerial in Seattle.
Check. The corporations and the CEOs, and the bottom line is the profit grows, the money talks. You don't talk back. They don't like you.
Talking about the WTO, I'd been hearing the talk going around on the internet about how people were going to come to Seattle and shut the meetings down, and I didn't think it was going to happen. I'd gotten cynical over the years.
Nearly every country in the world had joined the WTO by 1999. It was the height of the Clinton boom, and the world had never seen such prosperity. International trade was soaring, helped by the free trade agreements negotiated by the WTO when it was set up in 1995. the new WTO negotiations would secure a golden age of globalization for all, driven by the new free trade agreements to be negotiated in Seattle. This was the idealized version. This is what was supposed to happen in Seattle.
By the time of the Seattle ministerial, there was a mood, both in civil society globally as well as among the developing countries, that this organization called the WTO was not good for citizens and it was not good for development.
From the Philippines, Walden Bello, Director of Focus on the Global South.
So at this point, developing country governments had 4 years to realize that they had signed on to this series about 19 to 20 separate agreements. And the realization that had come to them was that in its totality, the World Trade Organization was profoundly anti-development.
And so while governments prepared for negotiations in Seattle, discontent stirred.
I think that people went to Seattle to really express their feelings and their outrage against the push of the corporations to have another round of liberalization of trade.
On the eve of the ministerial, the city flooded with people. Arriving from Ireland was Ruth McGraw, who would represent the concerns of Irish civil society.
Well, at the time, I was just expecting to go to, you know, a big international government meeting. There was no inkling in my mind of what was to come. It was all very quiet.
The quiet would not last. Dissent began to fill the streets. Walden Bello again.
When people got there and realized that there were tremendous numbers of them on the streets, that the mobilization had exceeded expectations, there was this feeling that something was going to happen that was on the streets and then among developing country governments.
Among the protesters, singer-songwriter Jim Page.
Going to downtown, what I saw was, it was incredible. I didn't expect anything like that. The whole downtown area was basically taken over by the general population that had come to Seattle.
From across the spectrum of civil society, protesters began to make their objections heard.
The worry in environmental circles was that because multilateral environmental agreements were very weak, that whenever there was a conflict between trade issues and environmental issues, environmental considerations would be put in the background or would be subordinated to the trade concerns of the World Trade Organization.
The Teamsters had shut down the docks from Vancouver all the way down to San Diego, and downtown Seattle was what I like to refer to as a militarily occupied, liberated zone.
There was also concern that labor rights would be subordinated to trade.
There were people climbing at the sides of the buildings and hanging banners, you know, on the side of Nike Town, on the side of the Gap. It was just astounding. There were cops everywhere, of course, but you expect that.
And then you had a number of consumer organizations that very early on took the lead in exposing the WTO as really a corporate tool.
These were just some of the concerns in a mobilization of astonishing breadth.
So there was a defiant mood on the streets, and there was a mood of resistance among developing country delegates at the Sheraton Convention Center. And so certainly expectations began to run high that something was going to happen in Seattle.
Observing this on the inside, Ruth McGraw.
There was a definite sense of dissatisfaction from the very beginning on the part of the developing country delegates, you know, with the setup, because they're so outnumbered and outweighed by the larger countries, and they're very aware of this, you know, and very disillusioned with the whole process, I think, you know, and had been for some time.
The problem is that there was a great difference between the economics textbook's glowing vision about free trade in the WTO and the reality that free trade actually was corporate trade, and the reality that the WTO was really very anti-developmental in its thrust, and that there was a great deal of difference between the interests of people being served and the interests of transnational corporations, which were mainly the ones that benefited from free trade and the establishment of the World Trade Organization. I think that everybody had the sense that the WTO had to be confronted in a fairly massive way.
November 30th, 1999, it was a Tuesday morning when we drew the line. It was a WTO coming to town, and we swore we're gonna shut it down. And they
and then early Tuesday morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, people went down and set up their blockades. Now by the time I got down there, it was under activist control.
And they raged and roared and their tempers flared, and there were bombs bursting in the daylight air, and they'd run us on and do us in.
And all the key entrances were blockaded. You couldn't get into any of them because of the activists were there.
Shut it down, didn't we?
On the inside, Ruth McGraw.
Oh, it was amazing. I remember arriving down, and the entire building was encircled. And it was just a sort of incredible surprise, you know. Even just from chatting to delegates casually, like, you know, while buying a cup of coffee, there was this definite sense of, you know, kind of, oh my God, there are people on our side, you know, kind of, wow. And I think they felt very heartened by it, because they had all these screens all over the halls, and up on all the TV screens they have the schedule for the day, like, you know, when the meetings will be and where they'll be held. And what the screens were showing most of the time, instead of, you know, like what's happening next, was what was going on outside. You know, people were just rooted. They were just sitting there. They were just staring at the screens. They were just rooted at the spot. And I think they were just really heartened that for the first time they had a sense that, you know, that they weren't alone.
At its height, the mobilisation would fill the streets with 50 to 60,000 people.
The initial reaction was one of sort of astonishment that this thing had been brought to a halt. I think it took about a day for it really to sink into people what was happening. Initially, when it was the first day, I mean, it was all very exciting and it was very sort of encouraging and heartening. But there was a sort of a little bit of a feeling that, you know, well, that's grand, but they'll all be gone by tomorrow, you know, and they'll be on to the next thing. But they didn't. They didn't go away.
It was Tuesday afternoon, I don't know, 2 o'clock maybe, when the rumor went around that the meetings had actually been cancelled. And that was the most amazing feeling. You could feel the whole mob of people lift off the ground.
Shut it down.
They are urging protesters not to repeat this tomorrow. But no one quite sure what could happen with the WTO and protesters still in town.
Power to the people! Power to the people!
Till now, the WTO had been very much a closed shop. Delegates went in, they did their talking and they left, and the general public were really unaware of what went on or what their difficulties and their struggles were. And I suppose they had a sense of, you know, being on their own.
The first day of negotiations had been shut down completely by the protesters. Only with increasingly heavy-handed police tactics did negotiations begin on December 1st. But there was much more to the mobilization than protest.
There were forums. Noam Chomsky would be there. Vandana Shiva was there. All these workshops and forums before the actual thing took place. People from Mexico were there in Seattle. People, Jose Bove, the famous French farmer, was there in Seattle. People who experienced the other end of the WTO came to Seattle, and the activists that had been working on the process were in Seattle.
And watching closely from India was Shisha Reddy, honorary president of the Karnataka State Farmers Association.
We have got your support to the fight that has taken place in Seattle. It is a very good protest. We appreciated it. And we are proud that our people have worked there against these policies of WTO.
There must have been 50,000 out there. There were farmers, unions, rank and file. Every grassroots has its own style.
People representing all of these tendencies, Zapatistas and, you know, farmers in different countries, they were all represented. And you got that. You just got the enormity, the global scale of it. It was that. And I don't know if I can even describe it, but you felt that when you were there. Mm-hmm. The meetings were global, and the solidarity with these other groups was global.
There were so many people that you couldn't see. How that many people got into the city and the WTO delegates too. But we were locked down, so they couldn't get through, yeah, didn't we? Shut it down.
I mean, the big coup of it was, you know, first of all, to ruin the meetings on that day. And second of all, to get so many people's attention. So that, yeah, now we've heard of the WTO. Now we start asking questions. You know, why are these people from India here? Why are these people from Tibet here? Why are these people from Uganda here? And I don't mean delegates, you know. Why did they come up from Mexico in buses to be here? What's going on? You know, why did the longshoremen shut down the whole coast? That's a lot of trouble to go through for this.
Shisha Reddy again.
Every farmer's blood was rising in India. And all countries, including this, Brazil, Mexico, India, Malaysia, Indonesia, are suffering because of these policies of the WTO, and especially this policy of agriculture, that they are thrusting on the third world countries especially.
Placing the WTO firmly in the public eye, negotiations and protests continued until Friday, December 3rd. Ruth McGraw.
This particular morning, nothing was happening. The TV screen wasn't changing. Nothing was moving. And I noticed sort of as the morning went on that there were an awful lot of people milling around. About 5,000 people just sitting around drinking coffee. And I couldn't understand why they weren't in meetings. Most of them were from developing countries.
Negotiations had retreated into a so-called green room, the WTO's term for an exclusive invitation-only session.
And as the day wore on, they became more and more sort of restless, and it became clear that they weren't in meetings because they weren't allowed. They were excluded from the closed or the green room meetings. I remember sitting down at 5 o'clock, and I was sitting down beside these delegates from Oman. And we were just sitting around, like, you know, a whole bunch of five of them, and we just started chatting to them. And we were asking them what was going on, because we hadn't been able to figure it out. And they just threw their hands up in the air and they said, "We don't know. We're not allowed in. We don't know what's happening. But we're certainly not going to agree to anything like this." And they started showing us, they had some of their documentation with them stating that they were not going to agree to anything coming out of this meeting. And it seems now that they were quietly all going off and having their own private meetings. The developing country delegates were sort of forming their own private meetings. And they, among themselves, during the course of the afternoon, had drawn up this declaration stating what their concerns were, why they were unhappy, and why they were not going to sign up to any agreement of this type because they were not being listened to.
This declaration would be the death knell of the Seattle ministerial.
Again, we sat around, I think it was until about 11 o'clock that night. We sat around, all of us, all 5,000 of us, or whatever number there was, not knowing what was going on. And then we were finally all called into this hallway. And there were a few people at the top, and they all looked like they hadn't slept for days. And they all looked incredibly depressed. And they sat there and they began to read out this big long thing. And basically the upshot of it was that an agreement could not be reached and that the talks were being concluded. And there was just this feeling of depression on the part of the developed countries, you know, and everybody else was sort of smiling in their heads going, "Yay!" And for the first time, the developing countries felt that they had made the WTO listen to them. For the first time, they had shown that they could say no and that they could bring the thing down if they were not listened to.
The people who demonstrated here represent the world's silent majority, noted the Trade Secretary of Papua New Guinea.
It is the victory of the people, victory of the movements. Here we celebrated this like a festival here in our various parts of our country.
You know, and there was this sort of sense of quiet jubilation.
The WTO, the engine of corporate globalization, had been derailed by the developing world.
And I think it was, to an extent, helped by the protests outside, because the protests outside definitely gave the developing country delegates heart. You know, it gave them the encouragement to stand their ground, because prior to that, most of the WTO meetings had taken place, I'd just say, quietly and in private, and they were isolated. They had no backup. We got chatting to them over the days, and there were all sorts of stories from development country delegates of, you know, literally individuals who'd never been to a meeting like this before, you know, being taken aside in corridors by, you know, six and seven US delegates and being bullied into taking a particular position. There were all sorts of stories like that. I think this was the first time the developing countries had felt supported. And I think the protests on the outside gave them the sense that they were right in what they were doing, that they were right in holding out. You know, it gave them the encouragement to stand their ground, and the moral support and the psychological support and all those things that help you stand up to a bully. Standing up to the giant when the going gets hot, and all you got is a slingshot.
Well, they tell me that the world turned upside down. You gotta pick. Anti-globalization is how the Seattle protests are usually described. But this is absurd.
You know, I was always kind of localized. You know, I would sing songs about different regions, and I still do. But suddenly things got global. At Seattle, for me, anyway, things got global.
In those 5 days in Seattle, a new global solidarity struggled to be born. A new global movement for justice.
During those days, I was down there most of the time. I got very little sleep. Very little sleep. And my eyes and ears were attuned, because this is my job as a singer. This is my job. So I waited a month after it was over to see if this actually was as important as I thought it was. And then I sat down and I wrote a song called Didn't We?
Shut it down, didn't we?
We sort of briefly called into the hotel where the Irish delegation were staying, just to, you know, have a chat with them before we left, because we knew what bar they drank in, and they just all looked so depressed and defeated, and we were trying very hard not to gloat, and it was really hard. But it was just huge sense on the part of the developing countries of, well, now they have to listen to us.
Music courtesy of Jim Page. Seattle sounds from the film This Is What Democracy Looks Like. See peopleshistory.net.
I come from one of the poorest countries in the world. It has been slowly but surely marginalized by globalization. When we begin to learn and understand how the multilateral trade system works, the first question that comes to mind is, how is it that my country is part of this immense project called globalization? The task becomes even more arduous when the sole and simple interest that our people have to be able to feed themselves becomes a utopia. It is especially difficult when we see their dirt-covered faces are too weak from hunger even to cry.
Subaltern Productions presents A People's History of the WTO.
The WTO's mechanism for trade liberalization is the round. Under the wing of the WTO, there would be successive, what they called, rounds of negotiations. And each round of negotiation was going to bring down more and more trade barriers.
The uprising begun in Seattle lasted for 2 years. But in October 2001, the WTO reconvened in the Gulf city of Doha for its fourth ministerial. This was the second attempt to launch a new round of negotiations that would have onerous consequences for the developing world. Director of Focus on the Global South, Walden Bellow.
That meant that in a whole series of areas, the idea was they would make more decisive efforts to eliminate quotas on goods entering a country, and that they would bring down even more radically tariffs in both agriculture and in industry and in services. And of course, they also hoped that they would bring not only trade, but also other areas of economic activity like investment into the ambit of the WTO. So this was a very ambitious agenda that was being pushed by the big trading powers, particularly the EU and the United States.
This time, in the desert of an authoritarian state, there would be no protest. This is the story of Doha, where the WTO launched the round that had been defeated in Seattle. It's the story of the quelling of the Seattle uprising and the silencing of dissent.
We do our best to obtain the benefits that globalization is supposed to bring. We do everything, including the impossible, to meet the obligations that multilateralism demands of us, creating legislation and even mechanisms that protect the interests of others. But what of our rights?
These are the words of an official delegate to the WTO from one developing country. They are reproduced here from an interview given anonymously to researcher Eileen Kwa.
I'm Eileen Kwa from Focus on the Global South.
From Eileen's research, we can begin to piece together what happened in Doha, how the new round was launched, and the rebellion of developing countries quelled. Shaken by the Seattle failure, rich countries were determined to succeed in Doha, where they had failed 2 years before.
They were definitely taken aback by the revolt of the developing countries, and they came out with this confidence-building package.
But the confidence of developing countries in the WTO was not restored.
I mean, it was a great public relations exercise, essentially. But it really did not deliver anything to the developing world. If anything, the European Union and the United States became even more clever about how they could devise ways to push through their interests and their agenda in the WTO.
The Doha ministerial began on November 9th, 2001. Our anonymous trade diplomat recalls the difficult position of a negotiator from the developing world.
My task, as well as that of my team, has been nothing more than to seek the benefits for a small economy within the norms of the World Trade Organization. However, it has not proved possible. I say this not because we do not have the negotiation capacity with which to reach our objectives, but to expose the different strategies that are used to keep us submerged in underdevelopment.
From the beginning, developing countries faced extreme pressure to abandon their positions and agree to the new round. The timing of the event didn't help.
Doha took place after September 11, just 2 months after. Even before delegates arrived, there was a huge press campaign by the United States trade representative to draw linkages between the so-called fight against terrorism with the launch of the new round. Well, I don't follow the logic, but apparently launching a new round was supposed to help in the fight against terrorism.
September 11th is an act to be lamented by all humanity. But what gives cause for even greater regret are the economic benefits that were extracted by the industrial countries out of this tragedy.
So there was a parallel made that if you're not with us in launching a new round, then you are against us and probably you are with the terrorists. Now, drawing that linkage made it very difficult for many countries to go against the launch of the new round. So there was a lot of pressure put on countries at that level.
We cannot deny that many countries that were making a difference at the WTO have been undermined and their officials removed simply for raising their voices in defense of the interests of their countries.
A strong leader of the opposition of developing countries to the new round was Pakistan. But in the post-September 11th landscape, Pakistan and its leader, General Pervez Musharraf, were vulnerable.
And at the Doha ministerial itself, Musharraf was in Washington discussing this package, an aid package in return for Pakistan's help in this fight against terrorism, because they needed Pakistan's cooperation in Afghanistan. Now, because Musharraf wanted very much for this package to go through, he called his minister from Washington and he told his minister, as well as the Pakistani delegation, to basically keep quiet. And the ambassador, who was much more outspoken, who knew the issues obviously much better and who was more aware of the problems in the negotiations and the inequities in the negotiations, was basically told to shut up. The package was signed the day after the Doha ministerial came to an end.
Is this sovereignty or a new form of colonialism?
Through 5 days of negotiations, under intense pressure, developing countries stood their ground. By the afternoon of Tuesday, November 13th, it appeared their resolve had held.
I know of delegates who said they left that night because they had booked their flights to leave, and they left feeling very confident that they would be in safe hands, their interests would be looked after, because there would be no new round launched, because the opposition in Doha was quite strong.
But that evening, negotiations again retreated into a green room.
On the night of the 13th, a green room meeting was held, and that included only about 22 countries. And this is where the most critical negotiations take place. So it means that the majority, about 100 countries, are actually excluded from the negotiations.
As in Seattle, access to the green room negotiations was by invitation only, as one Ugandan delegate discovered.
He found his way into the green room meeting and he was thrown out because his country's name was not on the list. So he was almost physically thrown out of the meeting.
Marathon negotiations continued through the night until 7 a.m. on the morning of November 14th.
So the text emerges in the morning with very little, in fact nothing, for the developing countries apart from a promise in the area of intellectual property rights and medicines.
This text would launch the new round, giving rich countries almost all they had wanted, while giving developing countries only that single concession on access to life-saving medicines. We held firm, lamented one African activist, and we held firm, and we held firm. But at the last moment, we were broken. What happened in those crucial hours in the green room? In interviews with dozens of delegates from developing countries, Eileen has pieced together some clues.
What happened in this green room meeting is that there was a lot of pressure for countries to agree, and there was even people getting angry. I know that the Canadian minister, for example, was shouting at the Indian minister for holding things up and basically shouting at some of the developing countries because they were being intransigent, in his opinion. So there was a lot of pressure to get countries not to break the consensus. You had the key countries, let's say Nigeria was invited into the green room representing the Africa Union. Nigeria was very outspoken before the ministerial. They had issued this statement basically saying that this draft did not represent the views of the Africa group. And so the pressure came down on these countries to agree to the text. When pressure is put on a single country, it's very, very difficult because every country has an area of vulnerability. It could be preferential access to the European Union market. It could be aid. It could be an IMF loan. And so it makes it very difficult for countries to hold out.
Much as Pakistan's opposition had been suppressed through its dependence on aid, so other countries appear to have been silenced.
Nigeria was speaking up to 6 p.m. of the second to last day of the ministerial. But what happened in that green room meeting, we don't know why, but Nigeria was very silent. It could have been because they had a debt issue that they could have been arm-twisted on. This is often the case. If it's not debt, it's trade preferences, exports to the United States or the European Union that could be used as a weapon to arm-twist these countries. So we don't know which issue exactly Nigeria was arm-twisted on, but Nigeria did become silent.
Within the World Trade Organization, there are many developing countries with different levels of economic activity. And regrettably, this has been turned into one of the most powerful weapons used against us, to divide and conquer.
When the Africa countries saw that this was the text before them, they were really quite angry with Nigeria because they felt that Nigeria had, in a way, betrayed them.
The usual practice is to make promises to a developing country so that it will defend the interests of a developed country, with the result that the developing countries are pitted against each other.
So they break one country or maybe a small group of countries from the other developing countries, and they could give some carrots to some and not to the others, and then you have the two groups fighting, and so there's a breakdown amongst the developing countries.
Apart from that, developed countries use pressure tactics. For example, political pressure, threatening to withdraw some type of tariff preferences and trying to discredit the people in charge of small country delegations.
Basically, the European Union has quite a strong hold over a large number of African countries and Caribbean countries because there are these trade ties from the colonial era. So some of the African countries export to the European Union and get guaranteed prices for their export. Now, the European Union uses this to a large degree in these negotiations to basically control the African countries so that if the African countries move out of line, these preferential arrangements are threatened. Now, I asked one African negotiator after the Doha ministerial, who was obviously very upset about the outcome of the ministerial. I asked him, so why did your country go along with it? And he said, well, we get preferential access to the European market in beef and in sugar. And if we had held out on our own, if we had stood up on our own, that would have been put on the line. Our exports would have suffered. So you can imagine that most developing countries are in a similar position. And so nobody holds out or no one wants to stick their necks out on their own.
The WTO is, in principle, a democratic organization. On the morning of November 14th, any single country could still have vetoed the Doha Agreement. But to say that the decision to launch the new round was unanimous is to ignore the power politics of the WTO.
A significant number of the so-called more important developing countries had more or less accepted the text. Since they were in the green room, it made it very difficult for any other country to stand up on their own. And so what happened in the final meeting was that there were several countries that registered their unhappiness, but they did not go to the extent of saying that they would break the consensus. And so in that way, the text was passed.
What will happen now? At the moment, it is very difficult to predict the future of small economies. But what is certain is that we have been led in the direction of slow destruction of our customs, our economies, and of the sovereignty of our governments.
The new round had been launched. The rebellion quelled. Were Words of Anonymous Diplomat, read by George B. Saremba. Music courtesy of Keela. See peopleshistory.net. In January 1930, Mahatma Gandhi received a telegram from the office of the Viceroy of British India. His Excellency regrets to learn, it read, that you contemplate a course of action which is clearly bound to involve violation of the law and danger to the public peace. The telegram followed Gandhi's announcement of a great march to the sea, where he would launch a campaign to defeat the British Empire. For 24 days, Gandhi and his followers marched. As they moved from village to village, the world's attention focused, and great anticipation built for what would come next. He reached the sea on April 5th, 1930. There he reached down and lifted a piece of salt. Immediately, police began to arrest anyone following Gandhi's example, beating the salt from their hands. The crime was violation of the salt laws, which protected British commercial interests by forbidding the possession of any salt not purchased from official sources. Millions joined the salt satyagraha. In the following months, authorities packed their jails. They beat lawbreakers and even machine-gunned a crowd in what is today Pakistan. But by 1930, the people of India understood the power of Gandhian non-violence. They resolutely refused to respond with any violence whatsoever. The empire was brought to its knees. From here, it took scarcely a generation for the great European empires to crumble. The cruelty and absurdity of the age had been exposed. Never again would a foreign power dare to prevent people from producing for themselves even the basic necessities of life.
The peasantry in Mexico is almost non-producing because cheap imports of basic grains have taken them out of production.
The trade liberalization, as much as we appreciate that the intentions are good, we are not yet seeing the results on the ground.
In Uruguay, the small farmers have been wiped out of the land because they cannot compete under so-called free trade rules with the dumped products that come from the US and Europe mainly.
These imports from the United States, mainly maize, are so cheap that peasants in Mexico just can't compete.
A lot of people are now very poor. They can't even afford to grow enough for themselves.
There are huge subsidies which makes the production of maize so cheap in the U.S. and it is especially big agro-industrial companies that have huge lands.
For example, the government used to subsidize agricultural production. But as one of the requirements by World Bank and IMF, if Malawi is going to borrow any loans from it, they are not supposed to subsidize production.
The consequences of liberalization in Latin America have been devastating.
And because of that, inputs for production are beyond reach for many farmers. Production is very low. Cases of malnutrition are on the increase and poverty is increasing as well.
As soon as WTO came to India, suicides started here.
Which brings us to Cancun, Mexico, where the World Trade Organization held its fifth ministerial in September 2003. From Focus on the Global South, Aileen Kwa.
There is no empathy at all in terms of the problems that the developing world are facing. The issue of dumping, for example, you know, cheap agricultural products going into the developing country markets, destroying the livelihoods of developing country farmers. That has been a huge problem that has basically caused widespread unemployment and hunger in the developing world, and that has increased in the last decade of the WTO. But there is no empathy at all for the plight of the developing countries, even though they raise it over and over again in the negotiations.
As in Seattle, the mobilization against the WTO in Cancun was broad. In this program, however, we focus on farmers, and specifically the International Farmers Organization, Via Campesina.
Cancun. If I have to describe it, I mean, Cancun is a tourist resort. A highly costly tourist resort where there's nothing like a farming population in Cancun or near Cancun.
From Uruguay came Alberto Villarreal, in support of the farmers' movements of Via Campesina.
So the strategy designed by Via Campesina was to bring farmers and indigenous populations from nearest Cancun possible to be a significant force behind the demands that WTO be taken out of food and agriculture.
In coming to Cancun, the WTO had never been so close to the world's poor. And in Cancun, the WTO had never gone to such lengths to keep them away.
They had set up 10 kilometers of barricades. So there were 10 layers of barricades, each a kilometer apart from the other. So the social movements and the people were protesting 10 kilometers away. So if you were inside the conference center, you really existed without an idea of what was happening 10 kilometers outside.
On the far side of these barricades were 10,000 peasant farmers.
Via Campesina had an international delegation of about 100 farmers. But the bulk of the farmers were the farmers aligned with Via Campesina in Mexico, farmers' organizations of the most various types, which were determined to let the delegates that were deliberating about trade liberalization in agriculture, let them know and feel really that this is not what the small farmers of the world want.
There was quite a lot at stake for developing countries in Cancun.
Now, the nature of the World Trade Organization is that you negotiate with the others. You give something, you get something.
In Cancun, representing Irish civil society, Conall O'Queeve.
So, in exchange for what they're seeking, the poor countries are going to ask that they receive agricultural access. The poor countries are competitive in agriculture. They want to be able to sell into the rich countries.
As negotiations began, the farmers of Via Campesina marched to the WTO barricades. Among them was Ana, who had come with rural women's groups from southern Mexico.
There was a big delegation of South Korean peasants. Their presence was really powerful for all of us because we never had heard about the struggles in other parts of the world. They were so powerful that everybody was chanting with them. It was so powerful, so full of energy that they transmit this energy to everybody.
Amidst the angry farmers, Alberto Villarreal.
And at one point, suddenly, a Korean farmer who came with the Korean delegation, who we learned afterwards, had been consistently protesting against liberalization in agriculture because of Korean agriculture. He climbed the police barricade.
Atop the barricades and holding a sign reading WTO kills farmers, Korean farmer Kyung Hae Lee took out a knife. He thrust it through his heart.
His cry of WTO kills farmers became the cry of everyone, of every single mouth demonstrating in Cancun.
Wednesday, there began to be the hope or the expectation that there was a package coming together. It seemed like there would be a swap, that developing countries would give some access on services and on some of the new issues, but that the rich countries would give also something on the agricultural issues.
On the outside, Mr. Lee had been pronounced dead. News began to trickle in.
There were a number of different reactions. I think it's fair to say that people were shocked, but there was a sense that among some it was written off as, oh, he must be mad. You know, and it was seen as his personal, whatever his psychology was, rather than actually the political issues and the economic issues are so real and so pressing on these people that they have been turned to such despair.
There was a real denial in the convention center by the major players that his death had anything to do with what the WTO was talking about.
I can remember a number of years back when Irish farmers poured milk on the street. People were really articulate about this as a political act. But when a Korean farmer commits suicide on the street of Cancun, somehow people were unable to see that as a political act and only saw it as a psychotic out of control.
Mr. Lee, he was a farmer, Korean farmer, organized in a rather conservative farmers organization, who saw with desperation what was happening through trade liberalization in agriculture to the Korean farmers and to farmers worldwide. Apparently he had been hunger striking a few months ago at the WTO headquarters in Geneva for the same cause. And he saw this as the prime opportunity to make a sacrifice of his life that would advance the cause of small farmers against trade liberalization, and that would bring the issue to the heart of the negotiations and to the mind of the political negotiators that were brought into this.
I really feel like he was one of my people. I feel really sad because he's dead, but what he was trying to say, I can understand, because I think these economical plans is really a war against the people all over the world. It's a war that not many people are aware of, because there is no death, people dying by bullets, but it's people dying for starvation, because they are losing their lands, because they are losing their communities, the fabrics of their communities. If you kill the spirit of somebody, you are killing that people.
In India, 25,000 people committed suicide, and millions of people are suffering from poverty.
News also reached Shisha Reddy of the Karnataka State Farmers Association, a leading member of Via Campesina in Asia.
We saw it on the television and read it in the papers, and there was so much sympathy in Air India. There was so much sympathy with this Korean farmer who was ready to sacrifice himself, not only for himself, for the cause of the entire farmers. It shook us, and people wept in the streets.
And then what has been known through investigations and things like this became the mouthpiece of everyone there, that actually, yes, it's not only in India where farmers take their lives because they are totally desperate of their situation, no? But also in the US or Canada or in my own country, no? Where suicide rates amongst farmers have skyrocketed in the last years because of the immense crisis in agriculture, where all our food systems and agriculture are being taken away from small farmers who have been the ones that have developed agriculture really into the hands of big transnational corporations.
Farmers realized in this country the need to unite, and if we do not kill WTO, it will kill us, and with this it is spread from nook and corners of our country.
Come Saturday, shortly after lunch, when the text actually came out, there was shock. I have to say there was horror among the delegates from developing countries. It gave to the rich countries what they wanted on services. It gave to them what they wanted on the new issues. It gave to them what they wanted on the non-agricultural market products. And it didn't give to poor countries anything significant on the agricultural issues.
Oh my goodness, it did not reflect the negotiations at all. All the developing countries' views have been ignored.
And I remember talking to Mary Robinson, the former High Commissioner for Human Rights, and she expressing her awe at how can this be put forward as a middle ground text when it so clearly carries forward the interests of the rich countries and doesn't carry forward the interests of the poor countries.
There was a big assembly, and in that assembly, the people decided that the women have to be in the front.
As developing countries began to confront the text before them, led by the women, the farmers of Via Campesina again marched to meet the WTO at the barricades.
We went to the front, and there were hundreds of women putting the fences without violence, little by little.
As the women tore at the fence, standing with the farmers behind them, the Black Bloc anarchists, who had been much derided for violence at other protests, understood these tactics and expressed their solidarity.
In this case, Black Bloc held the babies of the Mayan women, which were at the front of the demonstration, facing the policemen.
And the fence was almost destroyed. Then the Korean guys tied some ropes, and the rest of the people who was in the demonstration was throwing. And finally, the fence fell.
With the fence destroyed, the women entered the restricted zone, where a memorial service was held for Kyung Hae-il.
We stayed there for some hours. Like, we want to show, at least symbolically, our strength and demonstrate our courage in his act. And I think we did it. We reached that goal.
Meanwhile, faced with the draft text before them, developing countries had formulated their response.
Africa was very angry. Some of the ministers and the representatives were saying, what are we getting out of this? We are not getting anything. What have we gotten in Cotton? Nothing. What have we gotten in terms of implementation issues? Nothing. Why is it that our issues are not being discussed, but the expansion of the WTO agenda is being discussed?
Even the vulnerable African state of Malawi, then suffering a terrible famine arising from drought and liberalization gone horribly awry, angrily denounced the negotiations.
And they even went to the extent of saying, which part of no do they not understand?
I was down in the press centre, actually, and a cheer went up across the place. So there was bedlam. Nobody really knew what was going on. But the word was that the talks had collapsed.
The ministerial collapse because the US and the EU went too far, basically. They were pushing their agenda and giving nothing.
The crux of it is that the rich countries were surprised by the degree of organization of the poor countries.
There was unity in the developing world. And because of this unity, it became very difficult for the United States and the EU to push the agenda through.
And they went to Cancun expecting that they could continue in the traditional model of whereby the rich went into a room and negotiated and came out and told the others, and the others signed up to it.
It is when Europe and US managed to divide and rule the developing world so that this unity collapses and there's no common agenda that the US and the EU are best able to push their agenda through. So because they were pushing so aggressively and giving nothing, the ministerial collapse. The developing countries stood up.
The whole revenue system has to be revised so as to make the peasant's good its primary concern, wrote Gandhi to the Viceroy in 1930. But the system seems to be designed to crush the very life out of him. Cancun Sounds from Cancun Indie Media. See peopleshistory.net. For more on how all of this affects farming communities in Western countries, see developmentjustice.net. In December 2005, the sixth ministerial of the WTO meets in Hong Kong. This CD is a Subaltern Productions North-South activist articulation. As the Hong Kong ministerial approaches, please feel welcome to burn, copy, broadcast, email, or even mass produce it for your local trade justice campaign or North-South Solidarity Group. As the global movement for trade justice gears up for Hong Kong, we leave you with a few final thoughts from Eileen Kwa and Walden Bello of Focus on the Global South, as well as Chukin Nanjunjaswamy of the Karnataka State Farmers Association. For more details, see peopleshistory.net.
I think Cancun, in a way, showed the developing world that if they got their act together and they stuck together, they can actually influence the agenda. However, I think many of them are only too aware. They remain very vulnerable.